Welcome to the Trinity's Podcast, where we explore theories about the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Do you love God enough to think about Him?
Episode 59, Dr. Carl Mosier on Salvation as Deification. Dr. Carl Mosier is on leave as an associate professor of biblical studies at Eastern University in Pennsylvania. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Center for Philosophy of Religion at the University of Notre Dame. He has a PhD in New Testament from the prestigious University of St. Andrews in Scotland, as well as degrees from Fuller Seminary, the Talbot School of Theology, and Life Pacific College. He's the author of numerous articles on biblical studies, theology, and Mormonism. He's co-edited the books The Gospel of John and Christian Theology, The Mormon World, and The New Mormon Challenge. But he's here with us today to discuss his research for a book he's writing on the idea of salvation as deification in Christian theology. Before we go to the interview, if you're listening through iTunes, would you do us a favor and subscribe to the podcast and also rate us and leave comments there? This will help other people find the Trinity's Podcast. Without further ado, on to the interview. Dr. Mosier, welcome to the Trinity's Podcast.
Well, thank you, Dale. It's good to be here.
Please tell us about your current book project.
Well, I've actually got two book projects related to deification. The first one is a contemporary biblical and philosophical theology of deification. So I'm trying to make a constructive argument from Scripture that interacts with a number of philosophical questions with regard to the possibility and coherence of the doctrine. Now, the second one is a more historically focused book arguing that deification is as much a Western doctrine as it is a doctrine of the Christian East. Tries to explain how it is that we came to think of deification as a distinctively Eastern doctrine, and then to illustrate its presence within the Western tradition, and in particular in the theology of John Calvin, who a lot of people think is the last person in the world who would have a doctrine of deification.
So you're doing both the theological and the historical end of this question.
Yeah, working on both simultaneously.
Dr. Mosier, in other religions, sometimes they hold out the promise that human beings should become gods or realize that they're really God deep down, or that everyone has a spark of the divine, or that everyone is a part of God. One could call these doctrines of the deification of humans. How do the traditions you're concerned with differ from these?
In the traditions that you mention, you have a couple of different variations of what's going on there. In some, human beings are thought to become deities, perhaps as objects of worship and veneration in the hereafter. We see this, for example, with some of the ancient Greek and Roman ideals. Others are pantheistic in nature. Deification is a kind of realization of the truth that we are all part of the one or God. But the Christian traditions are saying something quite different from this. They're not claiming that human beings can ever become deities. They're not claiming that human beings are merged into God and lose their distinctive identity or cease to be humans in their nature, but rather are making a claim that is rooted in the idea that human nature is transfigured, elevated, made more full by virtue of union with God, participation in God, through the person and work of Jesus Christ.
So you mentioned a couple of differences. One difference is that this is supposed to be a real transformation of the human. We're not just discovering something that was always true about us. And another one is that this leaves our humanity, our individual humanity, intact.
Yeah, that's. I think those are two very important differences.
One might still think that this is literally making us gods, though. I mean, it might depend on what we mean by the word God. If we mean just the common concept of God with a small g, like you see in polytheistic cultures, if a god is just sort of a very powerful, immortal being, then wouldn't we be literally made gods in that sense?
Well, there's a sense in which that's true. And what we have to do is look at the background to this terminology within the Christian tradition. So beginning in the second century with Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, Theophilus, Clement of Alexandria, We do have Christians who will say human beings become gods, or theoi in Greek, or that they become God, theos. But our words gods and God in these contexts aren't entirely adequate translations. Now, in a first-year Greek class, whether classical Greek or Koine Greek, students are going to be taught that the word theos means a god in the sense that we think of it, like the deities of the Greek pantheon or the God of Israel. But as you go on reading ancient Greek texts, it becomes clear that the word theos has a broader range of meaning than our words God and gods. And it begins its career not as a substantive or not as a word referring to a deity. There was actually a different Greek word that had that function in antiquity. But rather, theos begins its career as an attributive word. So if somebody, for example, saw a beautiful sunset or heard a singer doing an exceptionally good performance, he might say, that was theos, right? It was sublimely beautiful. Theos was often used as a synonym for immortality, athanatos, or incorruption, aphthartos, or for something that was glorious, doxos. We see the synonymy pervading lots of Greek literature by the philosophers, poets, and others, in which theos is used as a synonym for something that is divine in the sense of being immortal, incorruptible, or glorious. And that's the sense that the early Christians are drawing on when they begin speaking this way about human beings becoming theos or theoi. But they don't mean that human beings are becoming deities, even though these characteristics are often attributed to the deities of Greek religion, at least by the philosophers. Early Christian writers would see that as quite a blasphemous kind of pretension, and they're very careful to distinguish that the God of Israel is a theos in a strict and proper sense, and only he is, and that human beings are made theos not in their own right. They're not elevated to a pantheon like Roman emperors or Greek heroes were, but they are united with the one God and thereby participate in or share in his immortality, his incorruption, his glory. So they're not really theos in and of their own right, but by grace, by participation.
So you're saying that these early Christian authors have a monotheistic concept of God that largely, I guess, comes from the Bible, and they're clear that there's exactly one of those, there could only be one of those, but they have this word theos, which used to be an adjective, and then in their time is a noun, and it still kind of can be used descriptively, can call a being a god in that sense, not in the monotheistic sense, but you're saying that they're immortal and glorious and incorruptible. Is that right?
So the broad range of theos as an attributive term doesn't go away when it becomes the default word for a deity. Both usages continue side by side, and the church fathers are going to play off of the semantic range of the term. So linguistically, the word theos is a polyseme. It's a word with multiple but related meanings. And they're going to play off of that, much as we would be able to play off of certain words in English that can have related but quite different meanings. And for most English speakers, they're not going to be confused about what we're saying. So if I were to say, my wife is the love of my life, and in the same context, say, I love Notre Dame football, or I love pepperoni pizza, I love my dog, nobody's going to think that the sense of the word love in these sentences is identical in every occurrence. And if somebody did think that I love Notre Dame football or pepperoni pizza in the same way that I love my wife, that would be certainly problematic. And perhaps somebody who is not a native English speaker might make that sort of a mistake, but would be readily corrected. A native English speaker is very unlikely to be confused in that way. And in the same way, ancient Greek speakers could see the word theos used as a referent to the one God of Israel and as a referent to the eschatological goal or telos of redeemed humanity without being confused about that meaning and thinking that Irenaeus or somebody is making the claim that human beings become the God of Israel. It would just be intuitive to know that there's a difference in how the two words are being used, even though there is some kind of a relation between the two usages.
As you mentioned, many people nowadays think of deification as a distinctively Eastern Orthodox doctrine, which is pretty much absent from Protestant and Roman Catholic traditions. In your view, is this correct?
It's not correct. It is a long-standing assumption. It's certainly a commonplace that we see repeated in a lot of textbooks and in a lot of theologies. The fact of the matter is that deification has always been a part of the Western tradition. And that includes both the Catholic tradition and various Protestant traditions.
Why then is this such a widespread view?
The explanation for that goes back to some 19th century figures in Germany, particularly Albrecht Ritschl and Adolf von Harnack. Ritschl and Harnack put forward a view about the history of the development of doctrine, and particularly about the development of the dogmas of the Incarnation and the Trinity, in which deification played a very important role as the boundary between Eastern and Western theology. The Eastern Orthodox pick up on this particular telling of the history of dogma, but they're going to subvert it for their own polemical purposes. And because of these two narratives being incredibly influential on several generations of scholars, the idea that deification is absent from the West and is the hallmark of the Eastern approach to theology becomes a commonplace in the literature and something that, quote, everybody knows. But when you actually look at the Western tradition, you'll find that deification shows up in a lot of different Western writers.
19th century liberals like von Harnack, they understood this to be kind of a falling away from the original message and a corruption coming from outside influences into the Christian tradition, right?
Correct. So what happens is, if we go back a little bit further to the 16th century, the century in which the Reformation takes place, there were certain Anabaptist groups that rejected the doctrine of the Trinity on the basis of it being the product of Greek philosophy. This particular anti-Trinitarian argument gets picked up in the 17th and 18th centuries by people like Isaac Newton and Joseph Priestley, where they're going to argue that the Trinity is borrowed from, almost wholesale, from Plato or the Neoplatonists or some other Greek figures. Ritschl and Harnack want to get rid of these dogmas. They find them to be encumbersome, unnecessary, unduly speculative and metaphysical. So they want to complete, as it were, the argument of the Radical Reformation, at least the anti-Trinitarian wing of the Radical Reformation. But when they look at the historical sources, they realize that you can't actually make the argument that the Incarnation and Trinity are derived straight from Greek philosophy. However, what they notice is that frequently arguments for the Trinity by the Church Fathers are motivated by a doctrine of salvation that's oriented around the idea of deification, a kind of divinizing soteriology. The idea being that in order for Jesus to deify people, to make them immortal, incorruptible, glorious, divine in that sense, he himself must be divine. But the way the argument goes is that human beings are made theos by grace or by participation, but the one who deifies must be divine by nature. Must be divine in and of his own being, and not by participation in another or by the grace of another. And so Ritschl and Harnack, they look at that and they say, well, where did the early Christians get this deification idea? And they say, there we can see clear borrowing from Greek philosophy. They can do this because they notice that a number of the Church Fathers will quote Plato in his Theaetetus, section 176b, where he talks about imitation of God and union with God insofar as it is possible as the goal for humanity. And many of the church fathers see in this passage in Plato a kind of preparation of the gospel, that Plato is on to something. He's intuiting a truth that does not become fully known until revealed in Jesus Christ. So Theaetetus 176b becomes a kind of pagan proof text for the truth of Christian doctrine. So Ritschl and Harnack say, see, this is where the early Christians get this deification idea. It's a pagan notion. It's borrowed straight from the Greeks. And then what the fathers are doing is trying to find proof texts to support this idea. They're committed to this idea so strongly that they need to develop a theology and a Christology that can support it. And so they're going to say incarnation and Trinity are derived from Greek philosophy in a kind of secondary sense, as a kind of implication of the doctrine of deification.
Yeah, another source that would be in the background is the famous Cambridge Platonist philosopher Ralph Cudworth's gigantic book called The True Intellectual System of the Universe, which was published in 1678. And there, Cudworth, as a kind of Platonist, takes the line that you mentioned, that Platonism was a divinely ordained preparation for the gospel. And he claims to find the Trinity in Plato and Neoplatonism, which he takes to be a good thing because, you know, the Trinity was then known obscurely, maybe, by reason before it was clearly divinely revealed. So he was doing this as a friend to Trinitarian theology, whereas von Harnack was, you know, trying to peel back layers of unbiblical tradition in the Radical Reformation way. But the story is more twisted because you mentioned that, if I understood you, that at the end of the 19th century, Eastern Orthodox theologians were sort of looking for a way to reassert their own distinctiveness and identity. And what von Harnack meant for evil, they meant for good. They said, yes, this is our distinctive teaching, right?
Yes, something like that. So to continue just a moment more with Harnack, and then I'll explain how the Eastern Orthodox subvert this narrative. So in Harnack's view, he's going to say that the Hellenization of Christianity takes place when the second century fathers adopt a soteriology of deification, which then will eventually lead to the doctrines of incarnation and Trinity. In doing this, they have abandoned the simple message of Jesus about the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, and very importantly in the Ritschlian, Harnackian theology is they interpret a soteriology of deification as replacing a doctrine of salvation centered around justification by faith alone, the Pauline idea in Romans and Galatians of justification by faith. And on their telling of the development of doctrine, they're going to see the presence of deification as undermining justification, which for them is true redemption. When you get to Augustine, Harnack is going to say, well, Augustine early on has some statements affirming deification, but he rediscovers the Pauline idea of justification by faith. And in a footnote, Harnack says, and if I am not mistaken, Augustine brings the doctrine, that is deification, to an end in the West. Just a flat claim that with justification being rediscovered by Augustine, deification's brought to an end in the West. And in this, Harnack is assuming that deification and justification are in the same theological category, trying to do the same theological work. Harnack is going to go on and say that Catholicism during the medieval period kind of waxes and wanes according to how much influence Augustine is having. So when Augustine has a lot of influence, Catholicism isn't as bad as it could be. When Augustine's influence wanes, then Catholicism becomes more superstitious, more ceremonial, all things that Harnack doesn't like. He's going to look to the Eastern Orthodox and say, they just have unmitigated ceremonialism and superstition because they have this doctrine of deification, or in later Byzantine theology, it gets known as theosis. And because Augustine doesn't have a lot of influence and justification by faith doesn't play a large role, he's going to look at them as being fully apostate from the simple message of Jesus and that key insight of Paul. On Harnack's view, Martin Luther comes along and completes what Augustine failed to complete, namely adding those little words, justification by faith alone. So with justification by faith alone in Luther's theology, we have, according to Harnack, a full restoration of this biblical understanding of salvation. And Harnack will say, had Luther known about scientific history of dogma of the sort that he was producing, he would have been able to see that once you have a doctrine of justification by faith alone, you ought to give up the doctrines of the Incarnation and the Trinity, because you no longer have the theological basis from which those doctrines derive. You've rejected the whole reason for affirming those doctrines, so you ought to give it up. And he sees his project in his History of Dogma as a way of completing the Reformation and getting us back to the simple message of the fatherhood of God, brotherhood of man, justification by faith alone. Now, at the turn of the last century, Harnack is widely regarded as the most influential scholar in any discipline on the planet. He had been charged by Kaiser Wilhelm to establish the Kaiser Wilhelm Gesellschaft, a scientific society, which then became the Prussian Academy of Sciences. Today, its successor institute is the Max Planck Institute in Germany, kind of like the British Academy or the American Academy of Science. Harnack, when he dies in the 1920s, has some 900 publications to his name. And this is well before the computer, so quite an impressive a number of publications, and many of which are very detailed, technical, and rigorous. So Harnack is incredibly influential, and when we get to the Russian Revolution, a number of Russian theologians are going to emigrate to Paris and then a little later to the United States. And entering into the West, they're going to be confronted with this idea that Christianity suffered from an undue Hellenization, that it fell away from the simple message of Jesus. And they're going to run into Harnack's claims that deification is the boundary between Eastern and Western theology, that the East has it, the West doesn't. And of course, whereas Harnack sees deification as a bad thing, they are going to appropriate it for themselves and say, yes, that is the hallmark of Eastern theology. We have it, the West doesn't. But on their view, what the presence of deification proves is their fidelity to the patristic inheritance and its biblical basis. And so they're going to make deification a big hallmark and return the favor that Harnack paid them and claim that the absence of the doctrine in the West is proof of the West's apostasy and that the West has abandoned its patristic and biblical heritage, and they're going to place the blame squarely on Augustine's shoulders. Now, a problem with both the liberal Protestant view and this Russian emigre view is nobody really went to check, is deification present in the Western tradition after Augustine or not? Harnack's influence was such that everybody simply took his word on that, and whenever they came across the a statement that looked like deification in a Western writer, they would either attribute that to hyperbole, or say, well, it's just an empty phrase carried over from earlier texts, but the author doesn't really understand what he's saying, doesn't really have a theology of deification.
Fascinating. So von Harnack was saying that the Easterners had fallen away clearly because they have this Greek doctrine of deification, and they turned around and said, no, you've fallen away because you don't have this doctrine of deification.
Exactly.
We know that in the first couple centuries of Christianity that Platonism, what we now call Middle Platonism and Neoplatonism, were kind of the prestige philosophies in that world. They weren't the only influential philosophies. You also had Stoicism and some influence from even Epicureanism and other schools, but to a lot of people, philosophy just kind of was the Platonic tradition. And I think that you do find in some of the church fathers thinking along the lines of Platonism, and specifically I have in mind Plato's so-called doctrine of ideas. Nowadays it's called realism about universals. So for instance, Plato believes that there is this thing called humanity, and that humanity is in both you and me. Either we participate in it, or we imitate it, or somehow it's present in us. And this universal thing, humanity, which would exist even if there nothing in space and time existed, even if there was no creation, this humanity would still exist. They think it's this humanity which explains why you're a human and that I'm a human, and this is supposed to be what all humans have in common. It seems to me that they do, some of them, assume this when they're talking about salvation. So, and I'm thinking of late 2nd century and early 3rd century people. They think Jesus participates in God's divinity, which is to say that he's divine because of God. And because Jesus is divine, then he's able to pass along this property of divinity to us, which deifies us or divinizes us. So there's an idea that you have to have a property to give that property or to transfer it to another being. And that's part of the Platonic idea. You have this kind of hierarchy of participation in these universals. But you said that you've seen this tradition of divinization as perfectly consistent with everything that the New Testament says about human salvation. Do you also see it as separable from this Platonic tradition of thinking in terms of universals, and specifically the passing on of this universal deity or divinity or godhood?
I think we need to distinguish between kind of a normative question and an historical question. So if we're thinking normatively in the sense of, can we articulate a doctrine of deification that does not make recourse to Platonic notions of imitation and participation? I think, yes, we can do that. If what we mean by deification is to be made theos, in the sense of immortal, incorruptible, glorious, with some other biblical themes put in there, which we may talk about later. Now, historically, now there's no doubt that the Platonic tradition is playing an influential role in how the church fathers articulate this doctrine. They are going to make a lot of use of the notion of participation. And it's not going to be exactly the same as when a particular is said to participate in an ideal or a form and exemplify it, but they're going to say that human beings participate in God in a way that's analogous to that. Parsing out exactly how this notion of human participation in God is similar to and different from a particular participating in a form is a bit tricky, because frequently the fathers don't really elaborate on that a lot. But they're clearly utilizing the language of participation, which does go back to Plato. They're going to also, as I mentioned, with you know, using Theaetetus 176b as a proof text, they're going to see imitation as a large part of the doctrine, and they're going to have biblical basis for some of this. So Ephesians 5:1, for example, says to be imitators of God. With regard to imitation, they're going to link that with the image and likeness language from Genesis 1 that gets picked up in the New Testament. And of course, Plato also uses likeness kind of language. In terms of participation, the idea of koinonia or sharing, communing with, that's going to also have some biblical basis, even though it's not always the terminology Plato prefers. Often you get methexis and other terms. They're going to see something similar there with passages like 2 Peter 1:4 about sharing in the divine nature, and various Pauline texts about partaking in Christ or being in Christ. So historically, there's definitely a strong Platonic flavor. And one of the questions I'm interested in one of these book projects is, to what degree are the metaphysical assumptions that many of the church fathers make, to what degree are they viable options for us today, even though I think that, you can have a doctrine of deification apart from them. Nonetheless, I'm interested in the question of to what degree can we share the same assumptions as the fathers on this?
Yeah, it seems like an important topic. The thing is that a lot of philosophers, a lot of Christian philosophers, reject Platonism about universals for various reasons. As a matter of fact, I reject it myself. I think the idea of participation or instantiation is just terminally obscure, and I think the theory raises more problems than it actually solves, and it's better to not believe in universals. What I hear you saying is that they maybe require belief in a shareable property, like divinity or deity, when it comes to the Father and the Son. But then you said, well, when we talk about humans being deified, it's not quite that they're sharing the property deity in the same sense that the Father and Son share it, but rather something analogous to that. But then maybe they're not talking about participation or imitation in a technical metaphysical sense. You know, you could tell your students, imitate me in, you know, diligent scholarship or citing all your sources or something like that, and you don't thereby commit yourself to any, you know, deep doctrine of imitation in the Platonic sense, right?
Yeah, and in the Fathers, you know, we do find that the imitation language is often parsed out in moral terms, right? So we want to imitate God in how we develop our virtues. Some of them are going to use that language with more metaphysical baggage than others. So it's going to vary from writer to writer as to how much weight we want to put on that philosophically. And, of course, a big difference between the idea of participating in a form and participating in God is that forms are inert, whereas God is the living God, biblically. And the Church Fathers are going to put a lot of emphasis on the sharing of divine life. When we get to somebody like Cyril of Alexandria, for some example, he's going to pick up the language out of John 5 and John 17 about the Son having life in himself and the Son making making believers one with him and the Father in a way that is similar to how the Father and the Son are one, and going to parse this out in terms of the sharing of this divine life and sharing in the relationship of sonship between the Father and the Son. Now, the question then arises, well, how much Platonic metaphysics do you need to make sense of that? Or is the language to be taken in a looser kind of sense along the lines that maybe you mentioned or something in between, perhaps?
Dr. Mosier, thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Next week, we'll again talk with Dr. Mosier about the theme of deification in the Bible. If it wasn't a foreign corruption from Greek philosophy, then exactly how is it a scriptural theme?
Thanks for listening. We'll see you online at trinities.org. Till next time, don't forget to love God with all your mind.